Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Welcome to the Borough Market Podcast. In this episode, we're at the first of Borough Talks, a series of public debates throughout the summer which explore some of the most fascinating issues in today's food world. We kick off with Read, Cook, Live, the ingredients of a cookbook, with a panel made up of some of the most respected names in the cookbook world. Stephanie Jackson, Publishing Director of the Octopus Group, Peter Ross, Principal Librarian of the Guildhall Library, Monica Linton, author and founder of Brindisa, Borough Market's Spanish food emporium, and Felicity Cloak, author and Guardian columnist. Holding the reins is food historian and vice chair of the Guild of Food Writers, Angela Clapton. I asked each of them what they thought makes a good cookbook.
Obviously, lots of lovely recipes that seduce you into wanting to eat them and so on, but it's all about the storytelling for me.
For me, it should be one that's readable, so one that has good stories to tell, well written, and one I would like to cook from. So I think there are two things. Cookbooks you read and cookbooks you cook from. Cookbook writers who survive are characters who you can see in their books. You can hear their voices in their books. So those are the ones that really survive through the centuries.
I think essentially a book that's wonderful to read. To me, that's the most important thing. Obviously, the recipes need to work, but I like recipes that are more like a starting point as opposed to a finishing point, so you can then travel with that recipe. But the book's got lots and lots of other things to read apart from the recipe. So it becomes a companion. You can take it on the train, or you can take it to bed and have a good read. That's, to me, a great cookbook.
I think the cookbooks are extremely important in terms of not just reliable recipes, in terms of having a really beautiful object that you can hold and something where there's the length and the time to expand, to give something a bit of context, a bit of colour, and a bit of personality, because I think that's what's missing from a lot of online recipes. You don't get a sense of the person that created them and the land that produced them.
Your book is just out. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that?
It's called The A to Z of Eating, and it is basically a collection of my 26 favourite ingredients in the world. So it's a real departure for me. Things just real self-indulgence, but really lovely, quite eclectic recipes. And again, I felt that there's so much online, as you know, there's a million recipes, chocolate brownies online, including mine, which is great. But I wanted to do things a bit differently. So, you know, you're not going to find that many recipes, say, for cheese and Marmite donuts online, or soy braised pigtails, or, you know, a savoury rye porridge. So I wanted to do something a little bit that would capture people's imaginations, basically.
People think of that word in very different ways, that whether you're using it to cook from or to sit down and read, you know, they're just very, very different things. So cookbooks marvellously cover such a broad spectrum of what we need in our lives, and so it's still a very broad question: what is a good cookbook?
Something for everyone.
Yeah.
As we settle down to wait for Kate Howell, Director of Communications and Development at Borough Market, to introduce the talk, I asked some of the audience why they were here.
I just think it's a really nice way to get a bit of an insight into various different elements of the food industry and maybe meet some nice people and definitely eat some nice food.
Borough Market's my happy place. I've been coming here for 17 years. I used to live in Streatham and come every weekend. Brought my baby here. I was here the day before I went into labour with him for a chorizo sandwich. And now I don't live in London anymore and I still come back every time I come. I live up in Cheshire now.
Yeah. You come all this way just for this? Is, well, your very first Borough Talk?
I come for work, yeah, but I came for this today because I'm writing my first book, so I'm hoping to get lots of ideas and
What's
advice.
What's your book about?
Well, I teach cooking classes here and in California, so it's all about teaching in both those places and about how to cook delicious food for busy people who haven't got much time.
What's it called?
working title is Spinning Plates.
And what's your surname?
Wade, Gemma Wade.
Watch this space.
Thank you.
Evening, everybody. Welcome. Welcome to Borough Market. My name's Kate Howell. I'm Director of Communications and Development here. It's wonderful to see so many of you here right in the heart of the market for the kickoff of our Borough Talk season 2017. You've got a really exciting and very interesting evening ahead of you, which I hope you really enjoy. My job here is very brief. It's to say hello, welcome. Welcome to this beautiful spring day that we're experiencing. The blankets are on your right, should you need to snug up a little bit. We are going to have a chat with our wonderful panel ahead of us. The evening will be followed by food and drink from some of Borough Market's traders. There'll be plenty of time for questions at the end of the session. I am obliged to say as well that the conversation will continue for those of you who are minded enough on social media. We are on Twitter at Borough Market, hashtag Borough Talks, and on Facebook if you search for Borough Market, you might spot the back of your heads because we'll be on Facebook Live for this evening. Right, I think I've got that right. Have I got that right? Yeah, I've got a thumbs up. Excellent. So without further ado, I'm going to introduce you to your moderator and host for this evening. I know many of you are members of our cookbook club, so she'll be a familiar face to many of you in the audience. Angela Clutton, Vice Chair of the Guild of Food Writers, food writer, food historian, and really top of your CV, host of Borough Market's cookbook club. Top of your life, come on, this is a good one, who's going to guide you through this evening. So have a wonderful evening. It's great to see so many of you here, and I hope you can join us for the rest of the series. So thank you, have a great night, enjoy the food and drink, enjoy the talk.
Thank you very much, Kate, for that. Yeah, as Kate said, I work for Borough Market on the Borough Market Cookbook Club, and it's so lovely that we have so many Cookbook Club members here tonight. It's lovely to have so many friendly faces, but also to have so many people, Cookbook Club members and not, who obviously are here because we all share a love of cookbooks. So I think we're going to have a really, really interesting night because we have a panel who all come from very different points of view about cookbooks and the way that they work with them and what cookbooks mean to them. And I think we're going to, you know, hear a lot about that tonight before we then turn over to you guys and have your questions and your thoughts about cookbooks too. So just going to introduce you to our panel. We have here Stephanie Jackson. Stephanie is Publishing Director for Octopus Books. In her biog, she said to me that she doesn't really cook very much herself, but she's certainly been responsible for a lot of amazing cookbooks for chefs and writers that you'll all be really familiar with. Stephanie, do you want to tell us about a couple of the writers that you've been working with recently?
Absolutely. It's true, though. I am a poor cook, and I have teenage boys who are frequently astonished at how awful the meals are that I prepare for them, given that I work with some of the most amazing food writers and chefs who are out there. So
Give us a couple of names.
So I've just published a book called Prime, copies over there, written by Richard Turner, who is the exec chef of Hawksmoor, but also the man behind PitQ and Blacklock and Turner and George. I'm about to publish Oklava, which is a Turkish Cypriot cookbook by Selin Kizim of Oklava, a restaurant in Shoreditch. Hey. And this autumn, I have books coming from Sabrina Gayor, Alia Hercules, and Claridge's, who are publishing their very first ever cookbook in their history.
Very, very exciting. So now we have Felicity Cloak, award-winning food writer, author of Guardian's How to Make the Perfect column, and the New Statesman's Food Writer 2. You have just released your fourth book, is that right?
Yeah.
The A to Z, A Flavour Map for the Adventurous Cook, which I'm thrilled to say is our May Cookbook Club book for the Borough Market Cookbook Club. And everyone's very excited about it and starting to tell me what they're doing for their dishes.
Thank you, Stephanie.
Exhibit A, Stephanie, thank you very much.
Muddled expertly here.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Just very quickly, Felicity, can you just give us a bit of an insight into the inspiration behind this beautiful book?
So I wanted to write something, and I've been doing The Guardian How to Make the Perfect column for nearly 7 years, I think, now, which is quite a long time. And I really love doing it, but it's not always my favourite foods. Sure. And this book is all about the food that I really love to cook, my favourite ingredients. It's very, very personal, which, is a little bit of a relief after cooking other people's recipes.
That's very honest.
Yeah.
Then next up we have Monica Linton. Any of you who come to Borough Market at all will be really familiar, I'm sure, with Brindisa, which is a Borough Market stalwart and inspiration for so many of us. And your beautiful, beautiful book here, Brindisa, which is just fabulous. Do you want to tell us something quickly about the book?
Yeah. Brindisa, I started 30 years ago, nearly. So it's quite a long wait to bring a cookbook out 30 years from the founding date of Brindisa. But I really wanted to wait for the right moment because I wanted a book that wasn't just one-dimensional. I wanted to make sure the book didn't just appeal to Hispanophiles or just to Brindisa customers or just be a food guide. I wanted it to have lots and lots of different angles to it and to reflect what Brindisa's meant to me and to many of my colleagues for the last 30 years.
And so many of us.
Hopefully, yeah. And the three things I really wanted to prioritize were ingredients, recipes, and people. Because behind every ingredient and every recipe, certainly in my book, they're people. They're different people. Yeah. They're not my recipes. They're recipes I've collected.
It's a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful book. We'll be talking about that more later on. And then last but definitely not least, we have Dr. Peter Ross, who is Principal Librarian for City of London's Guildhall Library and responsible for the extensive collection there, which encompasses collections from the likes of Elizabeth David and the Guild of Food Writers, Andre Simon and more. And Dr. Peter Ross has this beautiful book called The Curious Cookbook. And it is curious of the cookbook. It's fabulous. Do you want to just tell us a little bit about that, Peter?
Yeah, it comes from my interest in everyday food, particularly English food. But I think the highlight of British cooking is in the late 16th, early 17th century. So sorry if you're all cooking now, you've missed the boat. So what I did was, it was commissioned by the British Library. I went through nearly every single cookery book in English between about 1500 and 1950 for curious recipes where people are cooking weird disgusting things and just wrote about them.
It's got the best title, The Curious Cookbook, Viper Soup, Badger Ham, Stewed Sparrows and 100 More Historic Recipes. Thank you very much for that, guys. So now we're just going to kick into the meat of this. Each of the panel is going to talk to you for a few minutes about their own particular perspective about cookbooks. Then we're going to open it out to some discussion up here before we open it out to some discussion with you guys too. So, Stephanie, I think you're going to kick us off.
Right. I thought I'd set the scene with just giving you some information about the cookbook market itself. I don't know if that's useful. But food and drink is the biggest single category in nonfiction. So it's a really significant part of the business of publishing. And it's in the region of 90 million in sales every year. So that was 2016.
Just in the UK?
Just for the UK.
Wow.
Yeah, this is just UK, and this is all Nielsen book scan. So it's like our official chart statistics that we use. The biggest growth category in food and drink at the moment is what I would call functional food and drink, mostly functional. I know, it slightly breaks my heart. And it's mostly cookbooks that aren't really about the notion that you might wish to eat necessarily, but they do contain recipes, it's fair to say, isn't it?
Mm.
Yes,
recipes.
I know. It's.
Yeah. What do you mean? What do you mean, Stephanie?
I mean, I don't want to name names.
Okay,
that would
all
be
right.
So rude, wouldn't it? Maybe someone else will. But there's a chap who actually, I loved his proposal when I saw it. Everyone else said they refused to publish him because they thought he was so awful. But they've been proved wrong. They've lived to rue the day. A chap with a beard. What is it, 15 minutes? So some cut, anyway, lean in something. Yeah. Anyway, that might be it. Anyway, he's been huge. I mean, he's driven huge. And you know, as a publisher with my business head on, if I was his publisher, I'd be even happier than I am now. Anyway, that category, and he's a good representative of that, has single-handedly grown by 12.9%, which is just mad in a market that's kind of flat, and you know, we publishers are worrying always that the entire market is in decline, so that is extraordinary. The next biggest category from a Nielsen book scan point of view is what they call national and regional food, okay? And this is more where I'm interested in certainly Monica's book sits. There are four key cuisines within that. The best-selling of them all is Middle Eastern. We have Yotam Ottolenghi to thank for that. The second category in that, surprisingly, perhaps, because it from my point of view as a publisher, I haven't seen much lately, although I suppose it's River Cafe. It's Italian. The third category is Indian. Indian is dominated currently by very low price point books, so there are way more Indian cookbooks out there than anything else, but they're all quite low price point. I think it's probably like 100 chicken curry type titles. And then finally, British. So that's the backdrop that we're publishing against. Yep.
And have you really seen that change over the period that you've been working in publishing?
I mean, I've been working in publishing for 150 years, so things have changed a lot in my time. And I think when I began in the 80s, when I first moved here, you might have noticed I'm not a local, but I moved here in the 80s, and there was this person called Delia, who like everyone was really excited about, and I'm afraid, I was like, who, what? I didn't get it. But those books that were kind of Bibles, really, for people, I think were huge at that point. I think we then went through a significant phase of celebrity in its various forms, and now we're moving away from celebrity. Celebrity is mostly declining.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Why do you think that is?
I mean, it's funny because every now and again in publishing, we talk about Jamie Oliver having a bad year. Now, for Jamie to have a bad year, I mean, you know, like anybody else would be delighted to have one of Jamie's bad years. And I have huge respect, of course, for Mr. Oliver. He's brilliant, but he has historically driven so much. That age of the TV show dominating book sales, we've kind of moved on from that. I think people are smarter. I think there have been a ton of those sorts of books out there, and actually people are looking for something a little bit more distinctive. That's my feeling.
That's very interesting.
Disagree with me later on.
And can you just talk for us a little bit about the impact of the internet on the publishing world of cookbooks? I'm sure we'll broaden it out to a wider discussion, but just for a minute, just get your perspective
as
a publisher.
Okay, I'm just going to say, I don't think it's had any impact at all, okay?
Really?
I mean, that's obviously not strictly true, and we can duke it out in a bit, but I think if you want to figure out how to cook the ingredients you have in your fridge, like right now, and I need to solve this problem because I have a piece of chicken and a pepper, or I know that I want to make scones, and right now all of my cookbooks are in boxes because we've moved house, so the quickest way for me to make scones, or as I did this week, English muffins, is I will Google it on my phone, right? So I think that kind of I have a problem to solve approach is perfect for the internet, and I'm sure we all do that, I think. But I think in terms of the cookbook market at large, I think, and I can't wait to hear what you all think, but I think we want to experience an object and be inspired and think about things and flick through and go, ooh, that looks, you know. And that's how I think people access cookbooks in the main, the kind of cookbooks I'm interested in, certainly how I do.
So the kind of inspirational, aspirational function of cookbooks is something which you really only get from taking it off the shelf and opening it and having a read.
And yes, you can do that with the internet, but I think it's quite hard. It's more difficult for that serendipitous moment of to come up on the internet, because I think, correct me if I'm wrong, I think mostly we're looking for something if we're going there.
Yep. Whereas the sort of the simple instruction of wanting to kind of know how to cook something, the internet is there more for fulfilling that particular bit of it.
Right. I mean, we were talking earlier, and Peter was talking about when Delia published the first book, and it talked about how to boil an egg, and like there was huge controversy at the time. But actually, having that in print was incredibly useful for a lot of people. Now, probably no one is going to go to their bookshelf to figure out how to boil an egg if they don't know. They're going to go straight to their phone. Yep. So, you know, of course the internet has a place, a really important place.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think that's different from what most cookbooks
It's kind of wonderful to hear you say that you feel the internet hasn't
damaged
or affected too much the kind of typical publishing world of cookbooks. It's not necessarily the answer I expected you to give, but I think it's really kind of wonderful that you have.
Hooray! I do believe that.
Felicity, if I just kind of come to you and carry on the same point, because when I'm doing the cookbook club, quite a lot of people talk to me about how they get recipes and what they do. And a lot of people say they Google Felicity Perfect, Felicity Cloak Perfect, Hot Cross Bun, Chili Con Carne, whatever it's going to be. And that's what they put into Google to kind of get to a safe, secure recipe of something that they want to know how to cook. Which is marvellous, obviously absolutely marvellous. But I would love to get your take on what Stephanie's just been saying and about the internet and cookbooks.
I mean, I use the internet an awful lot when I'm doing my research for my column, and I have a vast collection of cookbooks, but, I mean, just for finding out who's got a particular recipe or something like that, and it is easier, that's the problem. You can have all of these cookbooks, but it only takes a second to type it in, and I'm guilty, you know, I've got the timings for how I like my boiled eggs in one of my books, but it's still a lot easier just to Google it on my phone.
Yeah.
So I know I would very much like the internet not to significantly affect the cookbook market, but I find it difficult to believe that it isn't.
Can
to
you
be honest.
Just talk us quickly through your process for the perfect column? Because for anyone who doesn't know it, the idea is that you try and explore lots of different versions of recipes to come up with the definitive perfect way of doing it.
Yeah.
And so obviously to do that, you go through a lot of other cookbooks.
Yeah. So I think in cookbook terms, I'm probably what the fast food industry would term a heavy user. I actually went and measured them today for you. I have just over 16 meters of shelves of cookbooks, and actually they're all full, and I'm getting a bit stressed because my flat is tiny. So I think one of us might have to move out. Might be the dog.
I'll take him.
there we are, to the highest bidder. So I have a lot of cookbooks, and what I do generally is, if I have a recipe, for example, next week, sneak exclusive, it's going to be chocolate fudge cake for Easter, which is something amazingly we haven't done before. And obviously that is something that sends me towards a specific category of book, the baking section, which is very large these days because baking books are huge. And also there's a bit of a chocolate section in there. But then I also sort of want to do some particularly American. So chocolate fudge cake seems to me probably a popular recipe in America. And so I will probably Google various American sites that I know are particularly good to see whether American chefs that I respect might have a different take on it. Because, you know, American cakes often use oil rather than butter, and that's an interesting, is that better, is that worse, etc. And so I'll really try and get together five or six very different recipes for one thing, you know, whether it's difference in ingredients or method. And that does involve a lot of trawling of indexes, sitting on the floor going, is this one significantly different from the other? But the internet does play a big part, particularly with newer recipes. This week was, we did a whole roasted cauliflower, which is a relatively new recipe, I think, to most of us. But I'd been frustrated because I'd made it a couple of times and I'd ended up with a raw cauliflower or a completely burnt and soggy cauliflower. So I thought, this is worth investigating. And I didn't find any. I found one recipe for a whole roasted cauliflower in my vast cookbook collection. Yeah. And all the others are online. So, you know, with newer recipes, sometimes you find a gap in your collection. But historic things, I've got some really great old, you know, reprints of old cookbooks, and they're not so great online. So I think there's a place for both, certainly in my world.
And are there particular cookbooks that are your kind of go-tos for when you're doing...
There was a point where I actually had to stop myself using Simon Hopkinson and Lindsay Barham's prawn cocktail years, because I always try and have time to look at the comments underneath the recipes, and people were getting a little bit bored of me always saying how great they were. Yeah. So that is probably, for classic dishes, that really is beyond compare for me. I also like Nigel Slater is brilliant. I mean, I don't think that's a Guardian thing. I just think he's great. Delia's always worth a try because although she's... her recipes always work, which is great. From my point of view, and, you know, my column is very much what I find, you know, my panel find, you know, subjectively the tastiest. Delia tends to be a little bit underpowered. She sort of plays it quite safe, and I don't know whether that's a generational thing, but obviously I've got a debased palate, and I like, you know, the chili and the garlic and the fat, etc., whereas Delia's a little bit more restrained. You know, Leith's is always good. It really depends on what I'm cooking. I've got some favourites from all genres, let us say. I try and give everyone a fair chance.
And do you have any thoughts you want to give us about the future of cookbooks?
And not just because I hope to write a few more, but I do think that there's a place for a cookbook over the internet, because although the internet is wonderful in that it's searchable, which is great when you haven't got a lot of time, it's not reliable. There's a few sites that I think I know you, like the US website Serious Eats, they really do their homework. I think it's a brilliant site. But you know, with a cookbook, generally, when you get to know a cookbook, you know you can trust it, you can learn from a cookbook because there's space for people to sort of allow you to learn along with them, to really explain the method and say, you know, this is how you do a julienne or something like that. It's all, you know, it's not hasty like internet sites often are. They can be very beautiful objects, which is, I think, really, as you said, can't be underestimated when it comes to food, because the first bite is with your eyes is unfortunately true. And some of my favourite cookbooks, I mean, I'm a big Jane Grigson fan, and her books don't have photographs, and I still absolutely love them. But it can't be denied that flicking through a book with photographs is, you know, quite a tempting experience. So it can be very beautiful. But also, what the internet doesn't still tend to have is, maybe because it doesn't have the space or the recipes tend to be hastier, but it doesn't have the context that something like someone like Jane Grigson or Nigel Slater or Sabrina Gyor will bring to a recipe. So you don't just get the recipe. You know, there might be a million recipes for sort of Sabrina's tardig rice, you know, not hers, but a version of it online. But Sabrina will talk you through why it means so much to her and, you know, what, you know, her feelings about it. Or Jane Grigson will talk to you about how her apricot tart comes from the curate in her French village. Yeah. And there's that kind of historical colour that makes it an experience that you just don't get online. And that's why I think that it will be very difficult for the internet to entirely replace cookbooks, because it's a very personal experience.
I think what you just said is the most wonderful kind of introduction to lead straight onto Monica, your book, because it is, it feels like a labour of love, and it is so much a book to read as well as to cook from.
Yeah, I think it's, well, I wanted it to be definitely be a book that you could spend a long time reading and not feeling obliged to cook any of it if you didn't want to. There was enough going on in it to actually not have to cook any of it.
Yeah.
So you can use it both ways. I mean, it is, as I said at the beginning, I wanted to include people as well as ingredients and recipes. And because of my work in Brindisa and setting Brindisa up 30 years ago, my whole journey of Brindisa has been finding people who either grow food, make food, create recipes, and so on. That had to come through. I couldn't just do a recipe book.
Yeah, but it absolutely does.
So it's got about 34 food ingredient panels. It's got about 200 recipes. And it's got quite a lot of stories about people that I've got to know and love and places that I've discovered with them. So it's much more of a travel log. Always sounds a bit corny, but it is those roads of Spain that I would never have gone down if it hadn't been for the business.
Yeah.
And looking for that cheese or the grower of some special beans or something like that. And then that turns into the recipe.
And is that what you had in mind when you set out to do the book? Did you know it was going to go that way and be that kind of book?
Yeah, I mean, I did know it was going to go that way. It's a bigger book than my publishers here. It was bigger than we were going to really set out. The problem is it became a big book, but it could have been bigger.
Yeah.
In fact, it was going to be bigger. And Louise very carefully said, come on, we've got to just cut it back.
How long were you working on this book, Monica?
Well, it took about 6 to 7 years to really work through it because of these elements with the ingredients and the people behind the business in terms of the ingredients. I wanted to make sure that was relatively easy because that's what Brindisa is all about. So what I needed to do was just fact check that with the growers, go back with my colleagues and find out more details and make sure we had it all still up to date and it was all accurate. But the recipes were much harder because I collected those from all over the place.
Yeah.
My colleagues, Leo over there is one of the chefs who contributed quite a few recipes. Josette contributed recipes as well. But the ones that were more difficult were from the cheesemakers or the country folk that I met in Spain, because you go and you see them cooking the recipe and you think, I'm following that. And you write down the instructions as you think you're following it. And then you get back home and you think, oh, I think there's some steps missing.
Yeah.
And then you ring them back and they say, oh, you just throw a bit of that in and so on. And so you sort of, some of those recipes, you almost have to interpret them. You know, none of it should be frightening. None of it should be out of bounds. So if you read a recipe, it's very possible to interpret it your own way, because a lot of Spanish cooking, particularly in families, is you cook what's to hand.
Yeah.
So if you cook a rice dish, if you've got a rabbit, you put it in. You know, if you haven't got a rabbit, you put a chicken in.
Yep.
But so sort of that's the approach. So that's a lot of those recipes are, you know, you should use them like that to inspire your own thought process.
Yep.
And the book shouldn't limit what you do with it. And the photography is modest. There's photographs in there. But my feeling with photography is that sometimes it can impose, sometimes it can limit what you might do yourself. And I think the freedom that you gain by having words that speak to you as opposed to images that dictate it needs to be like this,
yeah,
is also a huge pleasure.
I think that's I think that's really interesting what you just said, and the idea about how books look and the importance of photography and styling is something which I think would be really interesting to talk amongst the four of you. But I know you're clutching some other books there, Monica. What are those ones you've got?
It's a little bit like Listen with Mother, because I sort of, they're a bit like security blankets. I had to bring them with me, because this is just an example of one of the books that's a Bible at home for, my husband's vegetarian, so we have this conflict all the time. We have to cook two meals, because I've got carnivorous children. So his is this Chinese vegetarian cookery book by Jack Santi Maria. And it's got so many recipes in. It's got no photographs. It's got about three recipes on a page, not unlike Jane Grigson's kind of books. Yep. But it's just invaluable. And this has lived with him, or he's lived with it, since he was a teenager, trying to cook vegetarian food in a family that, his own family, when he was living with his mum and dad. And then I brought this, which is completely different, because it has got so many details. But what's so enjoyable about a book with lots of detail is that on a weekend, when you've got the time, you can indulge the time, and it becomes almost like a best friend.
What's that book?
All About Braising, from Molly Stevens in Vermont.
Okay.
And it's one of those things, it almost becomes like a best friend, because you have a weekend to spend the time going through it. You can study, she has drawings of some of the pots, lots of explanations about the different cuts of beef that you might need. And to me, the weekends I spend a bit more time going through that, and it becomes a hobby, I suppose,
yeah,
much more than just a chore. So cooking for me at home is sometimes a chore, because I have a family and it's the week. Sometimes it's pure pleasure, and sometimes it's therapy, because, you know, cooking long, slow dishes,
yeah,
whether it's beans, whether it's braising, is quite a healing process. If you've had a busy week, or you've got ungrateful family who don't like what you cooked the night before, you just...
That's my life.
You just spend time doing something you know that's going to really work. And in the book, the Brindisa book, I have focused quite a lot on one-pot family dishes.
Right.
It's a joyous way to cook,
yeah,
and to be together around the table. So
I'm so anxious about a sign behind us. Fall over. Yeah, I think we're okay. As you just say, you know, different cookbooks fulfill different functions. How you want to feed your family and what it is you're doing, whether you want to sit and read something or whether you want to make something quickly.
Yeah, so I mean, for family cooking, I always use books like Ballymaloe, or general books have got absolutely everything and variations on some of the very basic things, even if it's just roasting a chicken. Then I will use chef-led books, if you like Simon Hopkinson or Angela Hartnett, or, through Brindisa, we've known so many professional chefs, and I've got a lot of their books. So that's weekend cooking,
yeah,
for us. Or therapy is braising.
<That's nice.
laughs> And then if it's learning or trying to enjoy a real read,
yeah,
if you like, it would be Dorothy Hartley or Florence,
yeah,
White, or some of those
lovely
books,
yeah,
that you probably wouldn't cook from nowadays,
yeah, yeah,
but they're going to just enhance your knowledge.
I'm going to take your cue from there, Monica, talking about some older books, to go to Peter's and say, patiently waiting at the end of the line, to give us some historical cookbook context for everything we've been talking about.
Yes, I wanted to sort of talk to you about something about the history of English cookery books. Because what's quite interesting about it is there's nothing new under the sun. And if you go back in time, you can discover celebrity cookbooks 300 years ago. So just very briefly, the history of English cookbooks starts in about 1500 with the first cookery book published in this country on cooking, but doesn't really get going until the end of the 16th century, when you start to get individual men collecting recipes together and publishing them. And you asked me a really interesting question on the phone when we were talking. It's who published them and why did they publish them? And I've never really thought about this. Historically, why did people publish cookery books? I think they published them to make money, which is what they do now. So in the past, you aimed your cookery book at your market, and the market for books in the late 16th, early 17th century is going to be quite well-off people. So your recipes are going to be aimed at quite well-off people, the sort of food they would want to eat. So you would find people like Thomas Dawson is creating recipes or collecting recipes that reflect the upper middle class's tastes in food. And then after the restoration of Charles II, you get what I think is a disaster in English food. You get the influence of French food, which has happened repeatedly through the history of English food. So it happened after the Norman Conquest. It happens after the restoration of Charles II because he comes back from...
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
France, with all these ideas about what good food is, and the sort of books that reflect that are like Robert May's The Accomplished Cook, which I would recommend to all of you as being a really wonderful, brilliant book published in 1660.
And it's quite cookable from, isn't it? You can look at those recipes and kind of work it out.
Yes, so Robert May actually gives you instructions.
Yeah.
Earlier, they didn't give you instructions. There are some quite early ones that do, but basically they gave you take a chicken and put it with some rice and boil it up and do that. I think English food is a disaster when it meets French food, and then we start to forget about the importance of French food and we start cooking British food. We like to gather things in. So by the early 18th century, you start to get women writers, which are much more interesting in many ways, because we can guarantee that they're probably actually really are cooking this food and not just collecting the recipes. So you then also get celebrity chefs or celebrity cooks in the 18th century, like Charles Carter, later on people like Simpson. These are people who have either worked for nobility and are publishing their recipes, perhaps as an advertisement for themselves to get another job, or they're running London taverns, and London taverns are really important. So these are things like the London Tavern itself. They're publishing books of recipes they cook in their restaurants. They're not called restaurants at that time. It's like an advertisement to come to my restaurant, which is what people do today.
Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it?
Come to my restaurant in the late 18th century, early 19th century. This is the sort of food you can get, turtle soup being the classic one in London taverns. And if you look at the instructions in books like Hannah Glass, which is probably the most important cookery book of the 18th century, Hannah Glass is The Art of Cookery, 1747, what she's trying to do is she's fighting against the influence of French complicated food. She's simplifying food for the newly emerging middle classes. So Hannah Glass is trying to give instructions to people who don't really know how to cook, or people who are going to tell their own cooks how to cook things. And then eventually in the 19th century, you get cookery books that are modern cookery books. So Eliza Acton in 1845 brings about The Art of Cookery, which is essentially a modern cookery book with a list of ingredients, the weights, the instructions on how what to do, what it costs. But she puts her list of ingredients at the end of the recipe, not at the beginning. And then obviously Mrs. Beaton puts her ingredients at the beginning with the costings, how many people it will serve, etc. And then good, clear instructions. So Isabella Beaton, her first edition is a brilliant book that's then bastardized by the publishers over the next 150 years. So a really important book, and I think it's been denigrated by lots of people over the years. It's a very interesting book. And then into the 20th century, you start to get people like Florence White, Dorothy Hartley, who are really interested in ordinary English food and writing a history of food. So if you don't know Florence White, she published a book in 1932, Good Things in England. Yes, which is gathering together recipes from history, and she advertised in newspapers for people to send in recipes. And it's a book that sort of was revived in the last 25 years, chiefly, I think, because Elizabeth David mentioned it and said it was a wonderful book, and everyone rediscovered it. And then after the Second World War, after rationing and things, you get Elizabeth David and Jane Grigson, who are very different people. They're not, I would say, they're not cookery book writers. They are food writers, and they're writing books to read.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
One of my favourite books is Elizabeth David's English Bread and Yeast Cookery, because there isn't a recipe till page 265. And I think that's the sign of a really good book, if there's no recipe for about the first 150 pages. And nowadays, you're getting all of that. You're getting celebrity cookbooks, people advertising their restaurants, people who are food writers, people who are actually writing recipes, and people are what they've always been doing, like Hannah Glass, is stealing recipes from everybody else.
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely right. And it's so interesting to hear you talking about people who had, you know, restaurants or taverns and wanted to get advertised and get people to come, which is obviously, you know, you have chefs and restaurants who are doing books as well. And it's so interesting how what's happening now in cookbooks actually may in some ways not be that different from what has been happening in cookbook history. But one thing which I'd just like to touch on amongst the four of you is very much about the production and styling and presentation of books, and we mentioned it briefly earlier about the photography and the importance of that now. But just to go back to you, Peter, in a historical way, would there have been drawings, sketches in cookbooks?
Yeah, so Robert May, in his Cupidish Cook, he has drawings of pie designs. You know, in the 17th century, people like to make pies and decorate them beautifully with cut pastry, etc. He has whole pages of pie designs in his books. And then in the 18th century, you get designs like that, but you also get, more importantly, is layouts of the table, because there was that style of serving a la Russe, I think it was. I can't remember which way around it was, where you laid out the food on the table, which was the first remove, and then it like a bit like a buffet, and then that was removed, and you laid out your second course or your third course. In the 18th century, they had illustrations like that. And obviously in the 19th century, in Mrs. Beaton, you start to get colour lithography,
right,
which then introduces colour images into that, and then it really takes off. But in the 20th century, it sort of disappears to a certain extent, not to reappear until the 1970s, good colour pictures in...
Certainly when we did the Elizabeth David, I think it was Summer Cooking for the Cookbook Club, and there are no pictures in that. And I know that there may be some people here tonight who were there for that, who found it actually quite difficult cooking from a cookbook that didn't have any pictures in it, because we're so used now to modern cookbooks being very much styled, you know, with almost every dish. Do you want to just talk to us, Stephanie, about, from your perspective, the importance of the imagery of food in cookbooks?
Right. I mean, I think your point about the 70s as being the point where a lot of photography was introduced is right. I started out my publishing career in a company called Dorling Kindersley, and one of the founders, Peter Kindersley, his whole thing was about the notion of lexivisual learning, and some people understand information by reading words, and other people understand information by seeing images of that. And therefore, what was really important in that company was to have detailed step-by-step, like, you know, beyond the pale for anything we would do now, but incredibly detailed step-by-step photographs of every single process. He actually first did that with The Joy of Sex, in fact. That was his big innovation then. And then he applied it to food and basic gardening and any other nonfiction subject you can imagine. So that was a huge thing at the time. And then I think it probably, I mean, anyone correct me if I'm wrong, but I think probably it became a bit of a, like, we're doing it because we can. You know, we can spend thousands and thousands of pounds on photography and produce these beautiful images. And gradually that was introduced. And I think what a lot of publishers feel now, and that's from feedback that we get from consumers and, you know, the people reading the books, is that readers like the images. That's one of the things we talk about a lot, is to what extent is this new book that we're hoping to publish going to be illustrated? And to what extent does it have to be illustrated? Because everyone out there who might buy it would like to have pictures. Mm. I think there's a move towards more in the direction of being a bit more sophisticated, arguably. I mean, I personally love books that are much more of a read. And I do like pictures to an extent because that gives me confidence to cook some things I might not try otherwise. I love what you said earlier about it, Monica, though. So I think we're looking for books now that maybe aren't so obviously, you know, there's nothing more dull than recipe picture, turn the page, recipe picture, turn the page, and like 300 pages are like that. That's really boring. We want kind of face or ebb and flow and pace. I also think there's a thing, just to pick up on something Peter said earlier about food books for the cookery audience that aren't necessarily entirely about recipes. I think that's a trend.
That's interesting. Can you expand on that a little bit?
I mean, a good example of that is one that I didn't publish as ever, and that was Tim Hayward's Knife book.
Okay, yeah, beautiful book.
So, brilliant book. Yeah. It's not a cookbook, but it's about food and cooking and, you know, implements we use.
Felicity, do you have anything you want to add about the styling production of books at the moment and in the future?
One thing that I'm seeing more of and that I rather like is the replacement of some of the photographs with illustrations, which I think don't tend to date as fast as photographs. I mean, if you look at even a book published in the 90s, sort of the first River Cafe books, they kind of strike you as the kind of style of food photography that wouldn't be used now. And I think that's a shame because it suggests the recipes are dated, which they're not. Although we probably use fewer sun-dried tomatoes these days. But, it sort of pains me that people say that if you don't have photographs, your book won't sell. And I know it's true because people like them, but I do think what Monica says is right, that it can sort of hold you back because something looks very sort of unapproachably beautiful because it's been styled within an inch of its life, when it doesn't have to be like that. But it does require a lot more effort to get into, you know, a recipe, to read it through, to imagine what it's going to be like, as opposed to just looking at a picture. So I'm, you know, I try and not be influenced by whether something's got pictures or not when I'm thinking about cookbooks I buy. And I hope that it won't become predominant. I mean, there's on the internet, there does seem to be a fashion for recipe blogs to have a picture of every stage of the process, which can be very useful if, you know, you're talking about whipping the eggs and sugar until they're white and voluminous. To see a picture of that is actually quite helpful. But to see a picture of the eggs being cracked, get to the recipe already. Yeah. You can have too much of a good thing, I would say.
That's very interesting. And I'd be very interested to hear what you guys think as well about the production and styling of books and what kind of cookbooks you'd like to read and how important you feel the balance of imagery and words is. We're going to come onto questions from you guys soon, so please start thinking about things you'd like to ask. But before we do that, I just want to run down the panel and ask you for your Desert Island cookbook. Everyone's been prepped, so they hopefully all have their Desert Island cookbook in mind. I'm going to start the other way around. Peter, what's your Desert Island cookbook? One to read from, one to inspire you, one to cook from, it can be anything.
I would say Robert May is the accomplished cook, but if I was going to cook from a book, it would be, I'm afraid, Simon Hopkinson's The Good Cook, actually, because his recipes are food I want to eat, which is really important to me. So that's the one I always turn to. If I want to read a cookery book, then it would be Jane Grigson's Food with the Famous, which is probably one of her least known books.
I don't know that.
So everyone knows, French book cookery, whatever it is. So Food with the Famous is basically a book where each chapter is about somebody from history, and she finds recipes relating to that person.
Oh, great.
And it's a really brilliant book. It introduced me to, just mention this, to one person who's called Parson Woodford. You may know him. He was a diarist in the late 18th century. Nothing ever happened in his life. He lived in the countryside. Nothing ever happened, but he recorded what he ate every single day. So I would recommend Food with the Famous by Jane Grigson, and also reading Parson Woodford's diary, which is just superb and brilliant.
No, I won't do the actual radio show and say you have to choose one. You can have two. I'll get you two books. Monica, what are your desert island cookbooks?
Well, this is all about braising is number one for me, particularly if I'm with my kids who need a lot of meat, a lot of slow-cooked meat dishes to stay happy. As Molly writes here, sharing a meal from one pot, as you often do with a braise, creates a feeling of commonality that leads to sharing a congenial meal. The warmth of the pot from the oven, the concentrated aromas of slow-cooked meat or poultry or whatever, the tender textures and the deep flavours all contribute to setting people at ease. So this would be number one. If I was alone with my vegetarian husband, it would be Deborah Madison's Greens Cookbook, which has got no pictures either, and it's been a Bible. We've used it for all of our 20 years together. So it's a fantastic book.
Nice. Felicity?
I'm going to have a sort of uncanny echo of Peter's choices here. To Cook From, definitely The Prawn Cocktail Years by Simon Hopkinson and Lindsay Behrman, which I just love. Everything from it is brilliant. The possible exception of the Black Forest Gatto, which has a small issue, make mine instead. But that is just such a great book, and I love it, and I think that they both write beautifully. And then if it was also to read, if I was alone on this desert island, I probably would want Jane Grigson, but I think my favourite of hers is her English... Is it English food?
English
food. It's just, it would make me feel a lot less homesick, presuming this island is not Lundy or somewhere. just so much detail and just lovely. So, yeah, those two.
Nice. Stephanie?
Okay, I have to say, I have Peter's book on my bedside table.
Oh, thank you.
Your book, Monica, is in my office, and your latest book is on my desk at work.
Yeah. Is that a good thing?
yes.
It's far all good. From a kitchen.
It's all good. I mean, I love what I would call writerly food writing, and so I go back again and again to the likes of Nigel Slater's Kitchen Diaries or any Diana Henry, and I love Nigella. I'm a big Nigella fan. There's a book I really love, and I will just garble the name, and you will correct me, Peter. Edward de Ponen?
Oh, yes.
Cooking in 10 Minutes.
Yes, yes.
Written, do we know when?
Well,
a long time ago. 80 years ago. Right. And he has this wonderful recipe for oysters and hot sausages where he basically says, slurp an oyster, then pop in like a crackling hot little mini sausage, cocktail sausage, and then slug back a bit of champagne, I believe it is. and I love his recipes. They're all about three lines. They're incredibly, it's clarity, it's brevity, and it's intent. And I adore it. So that's my favorite historic example.
Okay. So we're going to open up to questions or just points that anyone wants to make. And if you'd like to tell us your desert island cookbook, then please feel free to do that too. There are some microphones coming around. If you can try and wait for the microphone to get to you before you start your question, that would be really helpful. Who wants to go first? This lady just over there, there's a hand shot up first.
Hi there. Hello? Yes. Ooh, that's loud. Hi. I was really interested in what you were saying about pictures and things, because although I love to look at cookbooks with pictures and I love the ones with stories, I do worry that maybe you don't sink yourself into a dish if all you see is the thing. And I sort of worry that there's lots of delicious things that don't look as beautiful as, say, cupcakes or salads with colourful radishes or whatever, which are very trendy at the minute. Mm. Are we missing out by being too picture-led, sort of in an age of Instagram and
so forth. I mean, if I could just jump in there, you've reminded me that if I'm doing a recipe that I need to shoot myself, so in my book, not all of the recipes are photographed because there are a lot of recipes and there's a lot of text as well, so I think photographs would have been too much. So there are some. And obviously the ones that got picked for the photographs were the ones that sort of are very colourful or, you know, not the... I always think that the most delicious food is often quite brown, which is unfortunate. But if I'm cooking something, say, for the Guardian column, and you can see why people always finish with a sprinkle of herbs or, you know, the modern things and pomegranate seeds. It's not always... They rarely do a dish harm, but it's not always that they're absolutely necessary. Yeah. It's just that otherwise people say... Oh, that looks like dog's vomit or whatever. And so you have to do it. Or, like, put an egg in there or something. And that is a bit worrying because not all the best dishes are beautiful. Some of them are very, very brown. So I think you're right. It's a dangerous thing.
Brown food. Classic.
Yeah, love brown food.
Yeah.
Really into it.
Okay, so next question. Who else? Yes, please, down here. We've got a microphone down here.
Hi. I was just curious about what you thought about self-publishing and how that's going to change
Me.
Things. Well, sorry, I'm looking at you, I'm guessing. You've probably got an opinion.
Okay. I am not a big fan of self-publishing, which sounds mean, and of course I'm going to say that because I'm a publisher, but I think I know how hard it is. I've not written a book myself, but I'm really well aware of the amount of work that goes into producing any book. And I think that the thing a publisher should do for you is get your book in front of your biggest possible audience. So, of course, the publisher does all sorts of other really brilliant things. But the most important thing they do for the writer is deliver your audience to you and your book to that audience. And it's very hard to do that successfully if you self-publish. So it is possible. There are all sorts of exceptions that you'll hear about, particularly in various forms of fiction. I think if you have tried the traditional route of talking to a normal publisher and you're not having success, yet you really feel passionate about producing your book in book form, then of course you should do that. So it's not to say there's any, you know, shame in self-publishing or people shouldn't do it, but just be conscious that you're less likely to reach an audience. And I would hope that anyone who spends the hours and weeks and months producing a work can get it in front of lots of people and be rewarded for that.
Peter, do you have anything about self-publishing historically? To say.
The only one I can think of is there was Kidder in the Edward Kidder published his own cookery book by having the recipes engraved rather than set on in type. But I think the major problem with self-publishing is also that the design of self-publishing is terrible. The paper's usually terrible. The paper usually has that blue cast. People don't understand about, you know, setting the text away from the gutter, all those sorts of mistakes which make a book look ugly and bad to use. So I think that's the problem. And distribution is going to be the disaster, really.
Could I jump in? I don't know if this counts as self-publishing, but Unbound, which is maybe a halfway house.
That's not self-publishing.
Okay, because I was going to say that books that might have struggled for whatever reason, possibly the author themselves, to find a traditional publishing deal, like Jonathan Meads' new book.
I think they're brilliant.
Yeah, okay, so that's a bit different.
Yeah, and that's a crowdfunding model, and of course they've now partnered, I want to say, with Penguin.
I think it is.
Does anyone know? It is Penguin, isn't it?
I think so.
Yeah, they've partnered with a publisher. But they, you know, they're founded by John Mitchinson, who is a publisher in his own right. That is a bit like going to Kickstarter with any other kind of entrepreneurial idea.
You crowdfund for the money that's needed to get the book off the ground.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. Letters of Note is not a cookbook, but their most successful, I believe, book to date. And it's fabulous. And Canongate published it in the traditional publisher mode. Yeah. So that's a great route.
Just very quickly, Hannah Glass's book in 1747 was crowdfunded because she did it by subscription. So people subscribed before it was published.
Yeah.
And she produced a beautiful folio-sized volume from crowdfunding, essentially, in 1747. So.
Nothing new.
Nothing new.
Anyone else has got a question?
How do you think that social media affects books being published now? I mean, certainly Nigella's last book, I remember, had an entire colour-coded social media campaign. Do you think that the instant feedback provided by Twitter and Instagram is affecting the way that books are published now?
Monica, do you want to take that?
Oh, my goodness. I'm such a...
Do you engage with social media much with the Brindisi book?
We do quite well with using social media. It's something I find quite difficult myself to use, but I do use it. I mean, we did a rundown at Christmas time of recipes, and you don't know what effect it has. Yeah. That's the problem with it. Yeah. How do you measure the impact, really, on the sales? It's just part of a general effort to get it to people who might use that medium as opposed to a bookshop. I mean, I think, for me, great cookbooks are not going to really communicate through digital or through social media very well, because they have a feel and they have a weight and they have a whole series of other things that you just can't get across. So it's like a sort of, it's to entice you to go a bit further as opposed to, do you know what I mean? And that's what I would hope it would do. It might take you into a bookshop where you would get to look at the real thing and then hopefully buy it.
Well, they're saying that I get a lot of press releases about books that are coming out, and increasingly they will say how many social media followers the person has, which
does that appeal to you?
It really pisses me off, to be honest. Because if I haven't heard of them, and maybe they're in Made in Chelsea, then I'm thinking, I'm sure you're a great person, but do you know how to cook? And then I get the book through, unsolicited. And it says things like, first caramelise your onions, this will take 10 minutes. And at that point, I put the book in a charity pile, because I think you've clearly not written this yourself, and you've clearly never cooked. So, sorry, rant.
That's good. Lady of question, Daniel.
Oh, hi. For someone who's starting out in food editing or cookbook editing, what would you say are the most important things to keep in mind from the point of view of people who work with editors? So maybe you're creating your own recipes and you're having somebody edit them, or from the publisher's point of view of how you put things together and how you should learn and think about cookbooks.
Stephanie, do you want to go for that?
I'm not sure if this will totally answer your question, but I think for me, more importantly, something that's more and more important all the time is preserving the tone and the voice of the author, and don't edit the author away. Because the reason someone like me decides to work with a particular author is because I've fallen in love with them and their writing, and that is the starting point for me. And yes, the recipes need to work, but the individual style of that author has to ring clear. And so I think that's the most important thing, is don't edit the author away. Right?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, and it's always a temptation.
I mean, back when I was at DK 100 years ago, and we did publish Elizabeth David, by the way, but we were doing what I would call more functional books. It might be 100 chicken recipes, that kind of thing. And that was about getting the information out. So, there is a place for those books. But I think the kind of publishing that probably you'll be involved with in your career is going to be more about the stories that people tell and the characters.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if it's helpful, but in the Brindisi cookbook, we acknowledged Sheila Keating, who was the ghostwriter or co-writer. She was the disciplined person behind my madness. But it was incredible because we worked 5 years, 6 years together to get that to work. And everybody who read it afterwards says, Monica's completely there. It's not Sheila. So she had managed to do that. And she's really skilled. And she's done it that's her profession. But it was very comforting when people read it and said, that sounds completely like you. There was absolutely no question that I'd been edited out. Anyway, I thought it was a really, really big challenge to discipline me into something that was actually structured, which is what Louise and Sheila managed to do for me. But I'm very present, as you probably, hopefully, will find if you read it yourself.
The question in the back?
At the top of the conversation, you mentioned the word truth. And many, many years ago, I trained to be a chef, and there was a book by Cesarani and Kinton, I think it was, called Practical Cookery. It's probably about the 25th edition now. But it was our holy Bible. It was the only go-to book. And really, for you, Peter, so those recipes were strenuously tested. They were foolproof. How foolproof were the recipes in the 1600s, 1700s? And did they go through that testing, the rigorous testing that's required nowadays?
Well, I'm not sure we can know the answer to that. I would say if they came from somebody who was a professional cook, then they probably were rigorously tested in his own kitchen. But there would be no process for testing anybody's cookbook. But it's interesting that certain ones do survive. And if I just bang on about Hannah Glass again, published in 1747, it was still in print in the 1830s. So something must have been there that was useful to people. There was a way of describing recipes that people could understand. But there was, so far as I know, there was no way of testing the recipes at the time, except if they were writing perhaps in one of those London taverns and people had actually tried the food out, then that might be a way of doing it. But I really don't know the answer to your question, I'm afraid.
One more question, this lady just here.
Hi, I had a question about recipe writing specifically, and if anyone has any tips on do's and don'ts, or when writing a recipe or helping other people take family recipes and write them down in a way that can be shared. I volunteer with a group that teaches seniors in North London how to cook different things. So people bring in family recipes and they type them out and I have to make them look like they're going to work for 16 people. So I just was curious if anyone had any tips on things to keep in mind when writing an actual recipe down.
As I used to work in food magazines and I used to edit other people's recipes. And one thing that I always found incredibly helpful was to imagine myself making, I actually imagine myself making the entire thing from start to finish, because that's when you realize that you've left an important step out or something isn't quite clear. And also to realize that a clear recipe isn't necessarily a work of great beauty. You know, it's great if you can make it elegant, but it's more important to make it clear. So don't worry that you've said the word colander three times in two sentences. That's completely fine. Be my tips.
More questions? Let me go to the microphone to the lady just in the middle there.
I was just wondering whether you think that gender plays out at all in terms of cookbook sales. And if we look around the area tonight, we're predominantly female, I guess. But do you think that male chefs or cooks who've written are actually more popular, or is it not an issue?
Ooh. I'll just say I don't have any data on that. I didn't think to bring that. As a publisher, I don't think, right, what I need is more books by men or women or any other kind of person. I think the thing that's most, the single most influential thing in terms of just sheer sales is your exposure and the size of your platform. And it's a really boring thing I find myself saying to agents and so on who present me with new ideas, like, you know, someone from Towie or whoever would write a cookbook. If you have an enormous platform on, you know, national television and, you know, you're a columnist and you have shops and a restaurant and, you know, you have a million followers, then a load of people are going to buy your book. So whether you're male or female, that's the most important indicator of sales, broadly.
Well, I think, one last question. One last question at the front. Got the microphone? Just come down here.
Obviously, can I just say, that has none of that has any bearing on the quality of what you do. So we are not just looking for those people with a million followers and over, or, you know, the national TV programs necessarily.
Last question.
Hi. For a publisher, do you normally have just one person per book as a food tester? Food recipe tester.
Every single book is different. So I thought about mentioning this before. So of course there's usually a single writer, usually, although sometimes there are co-writers or ghostwriters involved. There is somebody who's testing recipes. There is somebody who is styling food for whatever photography there might be. There's a photographer, there's a photographer's assistant. There's someone whose job it is just to sort props out, you know, the plates and backgrounds and stuff. There is the person like me, the publisher. There's the editor, the person who actually day-to-day is shepherding your book through the process. There may be more editors on the team. There's a proofreader, there's a copy editor, there's an indexer, there's a designer. I mean, you know, I could go on. So there's this huge team of people who contribute to every cookbook that's been published up here. Maybe not back in the 17th century, slightly smaller teams perhaps, but there are a lot of people involved, and it just depends on the circumstances around that book.
I think that's a really good way to end, actually, because it was a lovely insight into the how a cookbook, you know, makes it onto the shelf, all the people involved in making
it village,
that happen.
They say.
Mm. Yeah. I hope you'd all stay and have some lovely food and drink and keep warm. The panel are going to stay, and you can ask some more questions. Please feel free to have a chat. We have some wines and Borough Wines, who are always an amazing supporter of the Borough Market Cookbook Club. Ginger Pig and Bread Ahead have also done some food, and Brindisa are doing some things for us. Monica, do you just want to tell us quickly what we've got here?
Yeah, it might be useful for you to know what we've got cooking. Leo and Ivan have been cooking. I think it's almost ready. It's called a dish called fideuà. Fideo is a Catalan word for short pasta, which I think the Moors actually brought over to Spain. It was called aletria in their own language, and it was brought over to the Catalan border, coastline, ages and ages and ages ago. And Catalonia and Italy, or Sicily anyway, do share quite a lot of ingredients. So it's like a paella, but it's not made with rice. It's made with fideo, and it's a seafood one, probably done, I imagine he's done it with cuttlefish and the most wonderful stock, fish stock that they make, a red fish stock called fumet.
Wow.
And a bit of alioli on the top. So there are a couple of versions in the book, one day when you manage to look through that, but Leo's a master at it, so enjoy it.
Brilliant, lovely. Thank you, and thank you all so much. It's fantastic.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Borough Market podcast. The next talk is How the Media Can Help Your Food Business, and is on Tuesday, May the 16th. You can get tickets and find out much more from the Borough Market website. While you're there, do subscribe to the podcast so you can hear all the latest from the stories behind the stalls at London's most famous market.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.